You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Ladies and gentlemen, come and dream with me.
Boy, all we gotta do is build an act, make you star. Dumbo the Great!
You're OG and I feel fine.
There, you slime-eating dogs, you scum-sucking pigs, you sons of a motherless goat.
I am big. It's the picture that got small.
I've never been alone with a man before, even with my dress on. With my dress off, it's most unusual.
What is it?
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Hey, what about Major Kong?
Wait a minute, I'm a reasonable guy, but I've just experienced some very unreasonable things.
Hello, this is Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Many thanks as ever to Ian Dayborn for the past 2 hours of music and chat, and thanks also for playing some Simon and Garfunkel there at the end to get us in the mood. But now it's time for another Bums on Seats, the film show full of genetically engineered super reviewers whose youthful complexions belie wisdom beyond their years. My name is Mark Liversidge, and joining me in the studio today are Yossi Osman.
Hello.
Rosie Applin.
Hello.
Dave Riley.
Hello.
And Ben Challoner.
Hello.
Today's show starts in fifth gear and hopefully will never slow down, except for snacks and toilet breaks, of course. Edgar Wright, the director of Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, returns with Baby Driver, a car chase movie with a killer soundtrack. Blockbuster director Colin Trevorrow opens The Book of Henry, and its re-release means we have an opportunity to look again at The Graduate, Dustin Hoffman's breakthrough, and a bleaker film than you might recall. Plus, as well as a review of the new South Korean monster movie Okja, only really available to see via Netflix, we look at the distribution landscape that this film and many others are now facing, with an interview with American writer and broadcaster Violet Luca. So lots and lots to come, but we start the show with Mirror, Signal, Maneuver.
So here's the thing. I'm looking at some of the country's finest thugs, and of course, young Mozart in a go-kart over there. People love great bank robbery stories, so let's give them something bold and brazen as to talk about over their lattes.
You're damn right.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
Director Edgar Wright first had the notion for his fifth feature more than 20 years ago when, on hearing the track Bell Bottoms by the John Spencer Blues Explosion, he knew he had the perfect song for a car chase. He just didn't have the movie yet. Now, with his new film Baby Driver, Wright has taken all the thrills of a Hollywood blockbuster, the gunfights, the bad guys and the idealised romance, and synced it all to his favourite music. Baby Driver stars Ansel Elgort as Baby, a teenager in the laconic Steve McQueen mode. Baby is a genius behind the wheel, groomed by a gangland boss played by Kevin Spacey to be the perfect getaway driver for a series of bank robberies. With his hearing buzzing with tinnitus caused by a childhood accident, Baby scores his life with music pumped through his iPod, choosing tracks that either match his mood or the situation he finds himself in. And it's to these pulse-quickening soundtracks that Baby drives, buys his coffee, and meets the girl of his dreams. Ben, to start with you, Baby Driver is made from very familiar parts, but does the Edgar Wright style soup it up to hot rod status?
I think unequivocally yes. As you said, he's had this in his head for a long time, and you can sort of tell watching the film that this is a film fan just gushing over cinema. There's references up to the hilt. I know a big inspiration for him was Walter Hill's The Driver, and I just vibed with it so much. It's one of those films where you just smile from beginning to end, and I don't think there's enough of that in cinema these days. You know, it's a lot of doom and gloom, and this was just fun from the very beginning.
Rosie, I can see you smiling at that comment as well, so I'll come to you next. Is it a case that you can make a successful film just built off references to other things? How much does that have to blend into the background while you're actually trying to make the film itself live in the foreground?
I think absolutely. I agree with what Ben said. It is a real film lover's film. And I think you can see the kind of development of Edgar Wright's sort of trademark style as you look back at his whole sort of back catalogue, even from the TV show Spaced. You know, there's some of the sort of same stylistic features there. But it is also, you know, just a classic story, and the characters are, you know, lovable and believable in that kind of cinematic universe that they live. So, yeah, it's more than just the style, but the style is such a huge part of the enjoyment of it for me. I absolutely loved it from the very beginning when, you know, there's the way... So a lot's been said about how the soundtrack works and the way that the music sort of fits in with what's happening. It's almost like a dance in the beginning, the opening sequences, and there's little sort of words from the songs that the main characters listening to are picked out on graffiti on the walls. And it just... That's the kind of thing when you watch a film, you just have a moment of glee at how it's been done. It's just so sort of pleasing, really.
Yossi, I can see you nodding as well. Is there a risk that actually this becomes then all about the soundtrack rather than actually about what's going on? It's a sort of chicken and egg moment. You know, are you driven by the musical choices to try and fit a story around it, or do we think Edgar Wright's got the balance right?
I think he's got the balance right. I have to say, the soundtrack is awesome. I spent half the time bopping while watching it. It was just so good. But I think that it's just a really great film all around. I have to echo what Ben and Rose were saying, because what I really liked about it, it just takes this classic sort of heist drama and it just is, but it's packed with originality. And I, you know, you just enjoy the whole thing. And the soundtrack, you know, it is part of that. The soundtrack is great, but I think as a total package, there's just a lot to love about it.
Well, it sounds like we're offering us a lot of originality about the film, and certainly in the way that the music and the car chase has been tied together. But actually, in terms of story, you've got the one last job theme on a heist. You've got this sort of typical group of bank robbers together. You've got the guy meets girl, falls in love. Actually, these are a lot of sort of film cliches almost. So, is it cliched, or is it something different?
It's not cliched in the traditional sense of cliché, because he's given it that impact and style that other movies that would have maybe, or other directors rather, that may have tried it, could have failed entirely. I actually wanted to give a shout out to someone from the crew called Ryan Heffington. He's the choreographer, so while Edgar Wright has, you know, assembled this soundtrack of absolute magnificence, if you don't have someone to organise everything, it's going to fall down flat on its face. And the job that he's been through, I imagine it was him and Edgar Wright both choreographing together. The two of them have pulled off this magic trick where everything is flowing superbly. And it isn't just about the soundtrack for that reason, and that's what gives the movie kind of the beating heart to go with everything else. And, it's just the best film of the year, isn't it, really?
It's good that you said it's not all about the soundtrack, because I was now about to ask everyone about the soundtrack. So thanks for that lead-in. In terms of the soundtrack itself, I think Edgar Wright's films have always had, you know, a strong link to their soundtracks. I think back to The World's End, which was, you know, a sort of collection of greatest hits of the 90s. The music sort of worked in very well. So, you know, I think there's 30 tracks on the soundtrack of this and another 12 to 13 that haven't made it in. Is there a risk sometimes you become too distracted by the music in this?
I don't think so at all, no. I love the fact that I think every song in the film is diegetic, meaning the characters hear it as well as the audience. So it's not just for feeling, it's for actually, you know, that they're in there with you. And I wasn't distracted at all. I thought it was really clever how he used, you know, the handbrake would go up and that would be a drum beat, or, you know, the window would go down and that would be, you know, a synth track. Gunshots was incredible. I recently saw Michael Mann's Heat again, you know, with a really loud bang, bang, bang. But when it's synced in with these songs, it's something else. Like I say, really elevated heartbeat, and I left buzzing. I actually saw it with Dave and we both just hugged afterwards. I was like, that was incredible, wasn't it? I just felt invigorated. And yeah, I can't say a bad word about it.
I mean, is it easy to underestimate quite how much of a technical achievement this is? Because as Dave mentioned, there's a choreographer involved with the stunt choreography. There are two editors involved, I think probably because there's the sheer amount of editing that needs to take place to get a film like this actually to the forefront.
They made it look easy, didn't they?
Yeah, I suppose my concern about something like this is if you know something is happening in advance, you're sort of told that this is synced to music, do you spend too much time looking at the gimmick, almost like a magic trick that, you know, you're sort of waiting for the punchline, you're waiting for the woman to disappear? Or actually, at a point, do you forget about all that and just get involved in the story?
I was just involved in the whole thing. I didn't really think about anything, like, you know, anything gimmicky or... you know, yeah, there is a lot of technicality behind it. I agree with that. But it was only after I went to see it that I really thought about that kind of thing. I think while I was there, I was very much in the moment, just loving every second of it. And I have to say, if you want to go to the cinema for some kind of an experience, you will have so much fun watching Baby Driver.
Yeah, absolutely, I would agree. And I think it's testament to how well it's been done that you don't think about the gimmicks. You just, as you say, it is just an experience. It's that, you know, all the senses kind of going on.
I mean, in terms of the cast that we put together, because you look back to Edgar Wright's films, obviously, which had his sort of cohort of you know, Simon Pegg, Nick Frost and people like that, and which has gradually expanded out into some of the greats of British TV and film acting talent. This is a very American cast. You've only really got Lily James in there, who's not American, I don't think. Apart from that, you've got a solid cast of, like, Kevin Spacey, John Hamm, Jamie Foxx, who are all you know, properly American. It's a very American set film, moved from LA to Atlanta to try and take advantage of that. And Edgar Wright spent time in Atlanta to try and make sure it sort of fit with that. So, you know, this is, Scott Pilgrim aside, this is his first really gritty American film. Do we feel that this is a real development for him?
It's nice to see that everyone's flocking to his banner, that's for sure. I actually want to mention John Bernthal as well, who is possibly my favourite character in the film, and the only downside for me is that he wasn't in enough of the film. More John Bernthal, please, next time.
Which was surprising, right? I thought, oh, he's there, and then suddenly he's gone.
Yeah.
With his name on the poster, of course.
So. Absolutely.
I mean, I suppose in terms of the acting, often films rise or fall on their lead characters because you spend the most time with them. And so you've got Ansel Elgort here. Is he just the sort of Hollywood pretty boy, or has he got a bit more of the James Dean thing going on?
I think there's a lot more to him. I've seen him in other movies as well. The Fault in Our Stars is the one I go to. We'll just shuffle the Divergent films under the carpet where they
thank
can
you for
stay.
That.
Someone go and tread on the carpet as well, please. His role in The Fault in Our Stars is very different to his role in this, obviously, in that he was supporting. And in this one, he's kind of front centre. And he just holds your attention every single minute he's on the screen. The opening sequence where he's, you know, just sitting in his car waiting to do the job, lip syncing along to Bell Bottoms, you know, Ben's about to have a heart attack again just thinking about it. It's absolutely amazing, the personality he's putting forth and everything. It's just a magnetic performance.
I have to say, I've seen a few reviews of this film which have said that they're very impressed with the technical achievement, but they didn't feel it had as much heart as some of Edgar Wright's other films. Agree or disagree?
I think that's an interesting point, because in some ways, I suppose the other films we've seen Edgar Wright direct are more kind of relatable, perhaps. They're more sort of set in a world that we can relate to. This is much more a kind of classic Hollywood kind of caper. I mean, the love story is quite important, I think, to the whole kind of heart of the film. Aspects of it for me did feel a little bit less, I could kind of connect to less. So the kind of the John Hamm, his storyline with his partner, I can't remember her name, unfortunately. But that just really reminded me of like Pulp Fiction, True Romance, all those kind of things. But their characters weren't, I wasn't really rooting for them so much. So I think it really was about that central duo.
It's interesting, I saw, I think it was Guillermo del Toro on Twitter, had described this, having seen it, as a fairy tale romance. It's sort of, you know, the Disney prince and princess transported to 21st century Atlanta. You know, is this a sort of modern myth-making that Edgar Wright's now tapped into?
I think you could definitely argue it is. Because the other bit which gave it real heart, I found, was the relationship between him and his foster father, which you don't understand what the relationship is at first, and then develops as the story comes on and he tells people about his childhood. And his foster father is also he's fully deaf, I believe. I don't know if he's dumb or not. Never goes into it. But the way they communicate, a lot of it is, I was going to say, it's not through the music. It's kind of through the music. His father listens to the bass coming through speakers to be able to hear the songs. And from that, and the way his son is behaving, he reads all his moods and stuff. And the conversations they have are brilliant. And another thing is they're all subtitled. It forces you to pay attention to what's going on. And, you know, if you want a more emotional heart, I don't know where else you would look.
Well, the other place I'd look in the film is actually towards the relationship with his off-screen mother, who, of course, is, you know, without trying to get too much away, has died before the film starts. And actually, a lot of his emotional core, you know, it suggested that maybe he's going back to Dinah because that's where his mother worked, and he's trying to hang on to the one tape he's got of actually with her voice singing on. And that, for me, was where the real emotional heart came in. You know, as somebody whose mother introduced him into films, you know, I had a strong resonance with that. I ended up watching Dumbo on Thursday night with my other half. Another great sort of mother-son relationship in films, a bit heartbreaking as well. So, you know, maybe it's a stretch to say this is the best mother-son relationship in films since Dumbo, but I'm going to say it.
That's quite a claim.
Wow. So, you know, I think we've sort of dispelled maybe the notion there isn't enough heart in this. Is there enough? Sorry, Ben, you want to come in and...
Just wanted to say, for a film called Baby Driver that is so marketed on, you know, the driving scenes, the chase scenes, one of my favourite scenes in the film was actually a foot chase of him running from people. And I thought it was incredible how they did that. If you can imagine a foot chase being like a car chase... and I just thought that was magical. I can't remember the last time I've seen something like that. I don't know how you guys felt, but that was the scene that really resonated with me.
Hey, Yossi is nodding, certainly. I think Rosie as well.
Yeah, I thought that was a great scene.
I think one of my favourite scenes is actually the moment in the kitchen when he's making some peanut butter and toast for his foster carer. Yeah. I just really loved that. I love the bit where he's sort of, it's all quite balletic in a way. And even those little moments, there's just so much thought that's gone into it. And the choreography, as you mentioned, just brilliant.
What do we feel about the dialogue? Because obviously it's a certain step away from what Edgar Wright scripted previously. And, you know, you've got all sort of witticisms like Mozart in a go-kart and, you know, you've got the cheesy lines. As somebody I saw described it as Kevin Spacey as reading every line like it's destined for the trailer. That is his entire performance. But actually, that to me actually seemed to work quite well. You know, he's you know, you think of Kevin Spacey 20 years ago sort of playing the slightly weakened verbal Kint and the withdrawn John Doe in Seven, and now here he's actually, you know, he's the sort of lead centre of the film. He's absolutely nailing that crime boss part.
Well, we were just saying beforehand how I think recently you see Kevin Spacey has taken himself very seriously, and this seemed like he was having such a good time, and I really missed that Kevin Spacey. Yeah. You know, the kind of wild card, you know, caricature almost, but I could just tell he was having a blast doing it, and yeah, I loved it.
I just love Kevin Spacey. So I'll watch anything with Kevin Spacey, and so
yeah, he's such brilliant. A joy. I was really happy as well to see John Hamm in a good post-Mad Men role, because I love John Hamm.
I do as well, and I'm a big fan of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which of course John Hamm appears in as well. For me, he actually maybe felt not the weak link, but he felt the least of the fit with the characters that he was playing, which is odd because the role was written for him and he's the only person that was in the film from the get-go. Everyone else sort of shuffled around and played someone else. It's a very testosterone-packed supporting cast. You've only really got Isa Gonzalez, who's John Hamm's wife in the film, and then Lily James. So, you know, is it a little testosterone-heavy? There's people coming out with a standard criticism of, oh, it's 21st century, you know, we need to have a greater balance of male and female roles, but that's not tapping into the kind of films that this is homaging and referencing, is it? So where is that balance, and did it hit it right? Everyone's now looking by my question.
I think it's a fair point, actually, I have to say. I do think, I mean, like I say, I'm so sorry, I can't remember her name, the name of the character that is with John Hamm's character. But
Darling.
How could I forget that? I did feel that she was a very familiar character in this. But again, as you say, that was a sort of homage type thing. And also, I felt, you know, there were moments where Lily James's character was... you know, had sort of personality, but perhaps there could have been a bit more done there. I don't know. She really existed to be the kind of romantic interest for Baby. So I think maybe there was a bit of work that could have been done.
The two most important characters, though, are female. It's his mother and it's Lily James, I thought. You know, you're right, they don't have a massive role in it, but they are the catalyst for the whole film.
Is there a risk that we then try and put the burden on every single filmmaker of trying to achieve balance with every single film they make? Is it actually better that we're celebrating the fact that there's some originality to this film? It's not a summer blockbuster that's come out of a stream of franchises. I'm on the verge of going back to my standard fallback. Dave, feminism, discuss.
Can I just say, sorry, Dave, totally woman-splain now? I don't know. But you could take the Jamie Foxx character and make it into... That could have been played by a woman. Why not?
I think, you know, swings and roundabouts, right? You have to... there's always room for improvement when we talk about, you know, getting that balance right. But I'm not going to totally criticise the film for... You know, it is quite testosterone-heavy, that is true. But I'm not going to criticise it too much for that because there's so much to appreciate about it. And yeah. I actually agree with what Ben was saying. You know, a lot of the, you know, the catalyst, there is... You know, those two female characters are very much a part of the film, and just take it, and you know, of course there could be more, but at least it's going in the right direction.
I think a good point to leave that one on. I think there's plenty more we could say about it, and so there may well be some more on the podcast. But for now, Baby Driver opened this past Wednesday and is now showing all three Cambridge cinemas, and it's a certificate 15. It feels like only yesterday we last discussed an indie director who made a blockbuster before returning to something smaller. Well, actually, it was 2 weeks ago when I last hosted, and we talked about Mark Webb's trajectory from 500 Days of Summer to Amazing Spider-Man to Gifted. Colin Trevorrow has trodden a similar path. After his low-budget drama Safety Not Guaranteed, he made the blockbuster Jurassic World, and now he's returned with the much smaller scale The Book of Henry. Naomi Watts stars as Susan Carpenter, a waitress, aspiring author and single mother to two sons, Peter and 11-year-old Henry. Henry is played by Jaden Lieberer, is a child genius. He's cleverly rigged the house and garden with labour-saving devices, while his knowledge of the stock market has created a small fortune. But what seems a jolly family adventure in the style of 1980 Spielberg films takes a much darker turn when Henry becomes concerned for his neighbour Christine, a young girl who he deduces is showing signs of family abuse.
You okay?
I'm good.
Mom,
I have to tell you something, and it's very important.
Christine is in trouble.
When someone hurts someone else,
we have to make it better. There's only one way to stop it.
I'd hope to do it all myself, but that's not an option.
There has to be another way to help Christina. Why, there's no way to help.
Mom, everything you need is right here. I'll be with you the whole time.
I know what you've done. Henry documented all of it.
Who do you think they're gonna believe?
It can't be left undone. No matter what, don't panic.
I'm not panicking.
We have to make it better.
Come to this door.
Rosie, The Book of Henry takes a number of unexpected twists and turns. Did the overall effect manage to convince you?
I'm sorry to say, no. I was not convinced by The Book of Henry. I have tried to think of some nice things to say about the film because I wanted to give a balanced review. So the first thing I'll say is Naomi Watts, as the mother in this film, does a great job. She's an incredible actress and she really does try quite hard. It didn't convince me because, unfortunately, tonally I felt it was all over the place. I don't think the structure worked very well. But I think crucial to my lack of enjoyment about this film was the fact that, and I feel very cold-hearted in saying this, the main character, Henry, is a precocious 11-year-old. He's very smart, and unfortunately I just found him incredibly irritating. And that meant that for the rest of the film, I couldn't really get involved emotionally as much as perhaps I needed to.
I mean, it's interesting comparing this to Gifted, which we reviewed a couple of weeks ago, which both have sort of child genii, whatever the plural is, within the films. But McKenna Grace in Gifted is portrayed very much as the young, likable. You know, she's the sort of emotional heart of the film as much as anything else, and so you're rooting for her and her plight. You know, the fact that this has gone completely the opposite way, trying to get you to root for Henry despite him, maybe, rather than because of him. Is that an example of one of these sort of brave decisions a film is trying to take, or just desperation on the part of the writer, do you think?
Oh, that's a tough one to answer. I mean, I felt that the character of Henry, the precocious 11-year-old, very bright, has a lot of, you know, he's got a lot of thinking about things, but I felt like his character had been written by an 11-year-old precocious writer, basically, who was like, oh, this is what would happen, da 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 da. And, you know, you just sat there thinking, when's it going to end? I'm sorry, I just couldn't enjoy the film. And I found it incredibly emotionally manipulative in a way that I grew to resent. So it was just like, button pressing, here's another thing to make you feel really sad. But I didn't feel sad because I was just irritated. Sorry.
Ben, did you feel sort of, you know, the sort of funny, ha-ha, funny, peculiar, sort of, you know, sad, empathising, or sad, tragic? Which was it for you?
It's going to be interesting because I do feel quite differently. I think I went into this film with a very weird sense of trepidation because I'd read all the reviews and I felt like this film has been crucified. And I thought, how can it be that bad? I went to the cinema and it was a completely empty screening. So I thought that's not a good sign from the start. And I think because my expectations were so in the gutter, I actually ended up really enjoying this film. It's funny you mentioned Gifted. Gifted is far and beyond the better film, absolutely. But I think the quirks in this film, the fact that it is a bit of a mess tonally, and I didn't really know where it was going, I actually kind of enjoyed that. I think I would take this sort of film any day over another, you know, carbon cutout, you know, remake or sequel that we see. And I'm glad that he did this between Jurassic World and Star Wars Episode 9 to do something so weird and strange like this. I thought was really, really cool.
I mean, is that the important thing here, that actually it's somebody who's willing to take a few risks and to do something a bit unconventional, even if they didn't pay off this time? Do we want to see more of this in our Hollywood films?
100%. We should be, yeah, rewarding this, I think. I know that I read an interview with Colin, and he was saying how they test screened this a lot and they thought they knew what they had from those test screenings, and they were not expecting the reaction it got when it got a wide release. So they thought they had a hit on their hand, a quirky indie hit, and it just got vilified.
I'm afraid I didn't think it was that unconventional. I felt at times like I'd sort of stumbled across the Hallmark Channel. and, you know...
You should rewatch a Hallmark film, because, honestly, they are rubbish. This I thought, okay, did a lot of different things.
So it sort of turns into a bit of a thriller in the second half of the film. And I felt like it was slightly more enjoyable at that point for me. I think it was the first half I really struggled with. But again, that it was tonally, it just felt like... How is that? It just felt like a bit of a weird shift, and I didn't really. And again, it just felt like it wasn't. It was.
Yeah, my issue with this is that actually I think all the component parts were there, but what was missing was that sense of satire on some of the films it was playing off, or a sense of humour or black comedy, something which would have actually given the film a little bit of life. Actually, it was played so straight, so down the middle, that it was a Hallmark Channel movie, but it was a Hallmark Channel movie where, you know, the script is torn up and everything just goes completely off the rails. you know, and I think actually in the hands of a different director, you know, I think of a sort of, you know, the early Tim Burton or a Paul Verhoeven or someone like that, who had a clearer sensibility of what they wanted, I would say it's starting to make me slightly nervous about Star Wars Episode 9, if Colin Trevorrow is this blind to what his tonal shifts are doing in films.
Did you like Safety Not Guaranteed?
Loved Safety Not Guaranteed.
Me too. And did you like Jurassic World?
Not so much, no, but that feels very much a conventional Hollywood product. So, you know, I think... The person I go back to is Jan de Bont, who made Speed,
sure,
and who made one fantastic film with a good script, and then the rest of his career was pretty much a write-off, because he never quite seemed to know when he was actually onto a good thing.
Twister, come on.
No, I'm not going to let you have that one, I'm afraid. I'm sorry. So, you know, Speed 2, I think, kills that argument stone dead. So, you know, I think, you know, We're supporting experimentation, but you know, experimentation, there's got to be a limit, surely, to how far that can go, or has there? Or should we just encourage this kind of bravery for, and welcome these failures when they happen, because eventually somebody will get it right? I can't describe already the appalled look on Rosie's face when
I
asked that question.
I know I'm in the minority here. I know Rosie hated it, and I know you, Mark, you weren't a massive fan. And I say the reviews speak for themselves. It got crucified. So I know I'm in the minority. I just say it is different, it is weird, and if you give yourself up to that, I think you might enjoy it.
I didn't think
it was that different or weird, sorry.
I think more people are likely to find something else than they will in, say, Transformers, which I had the pleasure of enduring for 2.5 hours on Thursday. And actually I think Transformers is a better film. Just...
Are you kidding?
Weirdly, I would rather see another Book of Henry than I would another Transformers.
I would rather have my arm broken than see another Transformers film, I think. I hate those things.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is how tonally bad everything was in the Book of Henry, but, yeah, I would encourage Colin Trevorrow to keep trying and just hopefully learn from what he's found.
I don't think
film.
He'll try again after this. I think he's been really kicked in the teeth.
We wait to see. So if you fancy seeing what all the fuss is about, the Book of Henry opened last week and is still showing occasionally at the Light Multiplex, and it's a certificate 12A.
I'm Mandy Morton.
And I'm Nicola Robson.
And collectively we present
The Eclectic Light Show,
a monthly arts magazine featuring
the very best in
theatre, music, film, books
and celebrity interviews.
Join us on the first Sunday of every month
from 2 till 4
on community radio
in your city,
Cambridge 105.
Hello, it's Greg here. I'd like to tell you about the Gift of the Cat show, where we play original 78 RPM gramophone records every other Tuesday night between 9 and 11 o'clock at night. And usually have one or two guests in with us as well. So come and join Kipper and me and enjoy the old music here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
In a few minutes, we'll be reviewing Okja, the new film from South Korean director Bong Joon-ho. But despite an all-star cast, including Jake Gyllenhaal and Tilda Swinton, Okja isn't available to see in any cinema in Cambridge. Heck, it's barely showing at any cinema around the world. Instead, Okja is only available on the streaming service of Netflix, who produced the film as part of their growing ambition to be a movie studio. They're not the only streaming service to be taking this route. Recent movies Manchester by the Sea, Patterson and Love and Friendship were all delivered by Amazon Studios, but found the inside of more cinemas. To get a little bit more idea of this rapidly changing landscape for cinema, Toby Miller spoke to Violet Luca, a writer and broadcaster for Film Comment. Speaking over Skype from New York, Violet spoke about the pros and cons of film streaming as distribution, from filmmakers seemingly given greater artistic freedom to make their films, to those films then simply vanishing into vast internet databases. But Violet began by discussing the very different approaches of Amazon and Netflix to releasing the films they make.
Netflix is a tech startup, even though it's almost 20 years old now. They clearly see themselves as, you know, disruptors, right? They're coming in with their technology and they're going to totally change the face of how we watch movies, and they're going to make all theaters redundant, just like how Uber is going to replace all taxi cabs, blah, blah, blah. And that's why they only have their movies on their platform, Netflix, and they do very limited theatrical runs of their films. But with Amazon Studios, they take a totally different tack, and they very much follow this traditional model of, you know, building up, you know, excitement, doing press screening, sort of talking, you know, look at the difference between something like Manchester by the Sea, which is an Amazon Studios release, versus something like Beasts of No Nation, which is a Netflix title.
All of you that have seen your family killed, you now have something that stands for you. It has put the weapons of this war back in the hands of you, the young, the powerful.
I'm a good follower, sir.
Beasts of No Nation has Idris Elba in it. It's about child soldiers in Africa, but like very few people have heard of this film. You know, it was supposed to be a big awards contender, and it really kind of didn't go anywhere, as opposed to Manchester by the Sea, which was a pretty small movie. You know, it's very talky, chamber drama, basically. Was it a fight? You know, it was like a big Oscar contender last year. So it's sort of like that visibility and sort of a, you know, Amazon's ability to sort of take risks, but also acknowledge that, you know, there are things outside of their video streaming service, and, you know, respecting that there are multiple levels of how people get to know about film, watch film, etc. So,
do you think Netflix can keep holding traditional cinema distribution at a distance? They've a hugely important Orson Welles reissue coming up next year with The Other Side of the Wind, which is something that really leans into cinema history. Then they have a new Martin Scorsese film, The Irishman, with Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci. That's in time for Oscar season. It's hard to see films like that being 80% a streaming experience.
I really hope Netflix doesn't just keep these things mostly on streaming. 80% on streaming. I live in New York, so a lot of times, you know, I will be able to attend a Netflix event, but I really hope that they do, you know, Netflix sort of abandons their approach, because it's, you know, it's such a shame to go through the trouble of restoring something and then you're going to watch it on an inferior platform. You know, it's great that they're making these things available. It's great, you know, it's kind of weird to think that no one but Netflix wants to give Martin Scorsese money to make this thing. But, you know, I hope that they, you know, this year, especially considering the sort of kerfuffle in Cannes, they recognize the error of their ways and they kind of give things, you know, the big screen time that they deserve.
Do you think there are benefits to this faux punkish attitude that Netflix has adopted? I'm thinking in terms of the freedom they seem to be giving filmmakers. Duncan Jones has a science fiction film coming out this year. John Ronson, who's the director of Okja. Del Toro, who has a cartoon on Netflix. And even Scorsese. They've all made a point to mention the artistic freedom that they've been given.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't want to apply the label punk to a multi-million dollar corporation that's very intent on, you know, complete industry domination, but...
That's what they think they're... I think that's the attitude they think they have.
Well, again, it's like all PR, right? It's all these PR terms. It's like, yeah, we're taking it. But I understand what you're saying, and I think that the people they have given birth to, you know, like the Wachowskis, letting them do Sense8, which is it's a TV show that's just like a big course in like queer studies and kind of, you know, I don't personally like it, but I think it's kind of amazing that they just gave them carte blanche to do whatever they want.
If you know what it means to be reborn a Sense8.
A what?
You saw her, but that's just the beginning.
I can feel you. You're not really here, are you?
You are no longer just you.
Now it's kind of shrinking again. You know, they canceled The Get Down. They canceled Sense8. They've made a lot of gambles that are very expensive that haven't paid off, like, in part because they just sort of trust people to check Netflix and have it show up. And that doesn't always happen. You know, this algorithm that sort of is supposed to help you, you know, navigate their library, it's very flawed. And, you know, I think we're at kind of a turning point or a shrinking point where they're clearly going to have to reevaluate how they approach these things.
Every year we're warned that mid-budget cinema is dying, that it's impossible to bankroll something that isn't a hugely expensive superhero blockbuster or a $4 million independent film. So I wondered if there was a possibility that the more modest aims of streaming companies could help fill that void.
Yeah, I think this is definitely an opportunity for those companies because they do, you know, obviously Amazon has a leg up over Netflix in the sense that film isn't the only thing that they do. You know, they've kind of got their octopus arms and everything. They've, you know, food, you know, just toiletries, any sort of service or product that you want to buy, you can basically get through Amazon. So they have a bigger cushion as opposed to Netflix, where it's like, if their TV show, you know, if Marco Polo fails, they lose a lot of money, and then there's no buffer for that. So I think in that sense, the type of films that you'll see coming out of Netflix in the, you know, in the next year or so, you know, what they're giving a green light to might change a bit, but I think, you know, Amazon, because they can sort of take a, you know, a gamble, not, I hate saying that, but like a gamble on something like Lost City of Z, James Gray's kind of transcendental period film, they can sort of bring back that mode of filmmaking, but that's still crazy because it's going to be only two companies doing that as opposed to every major studio doing that.
Finally, with all these emerging streaming companies, from Netflix to Amazon to Mubi to Shudder, is there a problem in that the way they deliver their service, it can rather pigeonhole the films and it can limit content?
Yeah, I mean, people are curious, and I think that, you know, there is sort of this idea that only people in certain places want to watch certain things, and I hate that, and because I think, you know, I grew up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and the theatrical options available to me while I was growing up were bad to non-existent, and, you know, I would have to drive 45 minutes to another city to see these art house films. But even, you know, there are so many people around me who didn't have that option, and again, it's the idea that you have to kind of like go out and search for it yourself is not great, but like, Netflix could address that. They have the ability to not sort of segment their audience, but that's the approach that they've chosen. And like, it's a shame, you know, because and I also think that, you know, sort of limiting titles to boutique streaming like Filmstruck, you know, it's marketed itself as like, oh, it's this service for film lovers, but that's another fee someone has to pay every month to have access to those really excellent films. And it's like, if you already have Netflix, if you already have Hulu, what is the chance of you going into that if you were just a young person trying to get into film? And so hopefully at some point, you know, there'll be, and that's the strength of Amazon, because they do bring together all these different, you know, they bring together Shudder, they bring together these pretty rare Asian film streaming services. They bring together a lot of different films, and they don't sort of ram down your throat what you want. So in that sense, it has a strength, and hopefully they'll figure it out where, you know, you aren't sort of paying cash to different people every month. But we'll see. Again, story is developing.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many, many thanks to Violet Luca for the interview, and special thanks as well to Julian Allen, film writer for the Reverse Shot website, for helping to arrange the chat. You can hear a much more in-depth conversation about the current changes in how films are released on the latest Film Comment podcast, which may be found on iTunes, and which we'd all highly recommend. Now on to Okja.
Hello, I'm Lucy Mirando of the Mirando Corporation. My scientists have discovered that while Mirando pigs dream peaceful and lovely dreams, those less fortunate pigs suffer from the most dreadful night terrors. We cannot know for certain what pigs' nightmares are like, but perhaps they're something like this. Pigs deserve happy dreams, just like the rest of us.
And that's how Okja opens, with a glitzy advertisement for new meat. Tilda Swinton plays Lucy Mirando, beaming CEO of an American corporate who have discovered a spectacular new super pig deep in the Amazon jungle. These enormous animals could, with careful rearing and humane slaughter, help end world hunger. One of these super pigs, named Okja, is handed to a farmer in rural South Korea, where he grows up to be a beast as big as a hippo, as friendly and faithful as a dog, and best friend to the farmer's niece, 10-year-old Mia. But then one day the authorities arrive to take Okja back to America. So Dave, does Okja work as a Netflix experience, or should it be seen on a big screen?
I didn't have the chance to see it on the big screen. I know a few people around Cambridge have. I know Toby in our studio has.
I think stress here because we're very proud of him. Toby actually saw it in Cannes this year, booing and all. So.
I would have loved to have seen it on the big screen, because on the small screen it didn't work for me. One, because my small screen is really small. Two, because it meant I could keep pausing it and make myself a cup of tea. I could get up and go to the loo. It was just... It spoiled the experience for me, and I kept fading out of interest in the movie because of it. And also, of course, I had streaming issues.
So, I mean, I think this is the grand trade-off that we come to, because I do have a lot of sympathy and sorrow for Bong Joon-ho. We had The Host, which played in a very few cinemas, when he was first making his name more than a decade ago. And then, of course, Snowpiercer, which never saw the inside of cinemas in this country, thanks to all the wrangling with the Weinsteins. So you've got that trade-off. You know, we've got a film which went to a distribution house and in theory should have had a wide distribution, but got caught up in red tape because they were trying to impart creative control on his film. Here, you have a film which may not see the inside of very many cinemas, but where actually Bong Joon-ho has had complete creative control. He's been given the money to go away and do what he wanted to. Which is better of these two sides, do we think?
I think it's tricky. I do think that the film, at times, I did think this would look great on a big screen in the cinema, because it does actually feel quite cinematic as a film. But I think, you know... Everybody has Netflix these days, and I think it is good that you can get films like this that are accessible on Netflix. And I'd quite like that I could pause it and go and make myself a cup of tea. And, you know, it's not the same experience that you get. But I think if he's been given that creative control, I don't see why Netflix is a bad platform for it. I think it would look great at the cinema too, and I kind of wished I'd seen it at the cinema, but everybody's got Netflix these days. Everybody's got it.
Well, I have to say, I was a little surprised by this. The amount of freedom which Netflix actually gives the people who make their product. We spoke to Clive Oppenheimer, who worked with Werner Herzog on Into the Volcano when it showed at the film festival last year, and I interviewed him afterwards, and he said, yeah, Netflix basically commissioned the film and then were utterly hands-off. So, you know, even for someone like Werner Herzog, they are putting the trust in the filmmakers and letting them do what they want to. So, you know, as much as I, in my entire film media career, have been an advocate of seeing films in cinemas, I can't get away from this feeling that actually it would be better if people actually got to make the films they wanted to make.
That's it. It's so rare these days, isn't it? You never hear from directors getting their complete vision on screen. It's always someone putting their oar in. So, yeah, I think it's really important for Netflix to do that.
And it is a bold project, and there's a lot of creativity in it, and I appreciate being able to see that in any format.
So let's talk about the product itself then, because it is quite a bold product in many ways. There's lots going on in terms of subtext. The one thing it struck me most as being was almost a bit of a pantomime, because you've got both Tilda Swinton and Jake Gyllenhaal who are giving over-the-top performances. Tilda Swinton with a very prominent set of false teeth, getting a chance to do a couple of roles. You've got Jake Gyllenhaal, who's possibly the most outgoing I've seen him in any film. But actually, the thing about pantomimes is they're generally very, very entertaining. But for me, there's a whole lot going on underneath as well. I think, talking before the show, we got the feeling that actually Ben and I maybe got more from it than everyone else. So to those that didn't quite enjoy it as much, what were your reservations?
My reservations, I think it would tie into, you were talking about tonal shifts in the Book of Henry, possibly the same thing in Occhio here. It didn't hold focus for me well enough. I mean, it's an absolutely beautiful film to look at, but at the same time, there's not a lot happening in some scenes. There's a 10-minute scene in the back of a trailer of people talking to each other in shadows and darkness with a giant CGI piggy taking up most of the shots, but the giant CGI piggy is just lying there, not doing much, and it's like, oh, at least make it be cute or something to hold my interest while this rambling conversation goes on. It's a shame. There's the middle half an hour, there's an absolutely fantastic sequence full of fun, action, adventure, quite a few visual puns as well, and I was like, oh yeah, now we're going. And then it drops straight into the boring scene, and I was just like, oh, I'll go and make a cup of tea. I mean, the thing is,
I would say in his defence that you can do that in a cinema as well. There's toilets, there's a bar, you don't have to stay in your seat in a cinema.
They don't make tea the way I like it. In a cinema, I never leave if I can help it, because I don't want to miss the experience. I find it far too immersive, and this is getting off point. I didn't find this immersive at all.
Well, I think it's getting very much back on point. Wow. I think we'll never know if you would have found it immersive had you seen it in a cinema.
I think I gave the wrong impression when we talked about it before. I did really enjoy it. I thought it is entertaining as a film, and as a sort of satirical piece, it was quite amusing to me. This whole kind of ethical capitalism point that it's going on about, and you know they've got this animal liberation front who are like, we're not terrorists, but they've got these masks on and are just like terrorizing everybody. And you know, there are things about it that just I really, really enjoyed. When we come to tone, I agree that sometimes the tonal shifts did strike me as a bit off-putting, because there were certain scenes where something really terrible was happening, like quite horrific, and then it would just switch to this kind of comedic dialogue, which I don't really think matched. And I, apparently this is what the director does. This is his thing. He loves to have these tonal shifts.
It's Korean cinema in general, I find, as well. Mm. You often have a lot of sort of abject horror mixed with comedy straight away after.
But I'm not sure it did work sometimes, but I'm not sure it always worked. Mm. Because I felt like sometimes it really struck me, and I saw that as a bad thing. I was thinking, right, oh, I've actually noticed that maybe they're trying too hard to do this, and it doesn't quite work. I don't know.
Again, I feel very lucky that I didn't feel that way. You know, I completely get why you felt that, but I did, and I wasn't bored either. Dave saying he was bored in that conversation in the back of the truck. No, I wasn't bored, at all. No. And I'm just very thankful that I wasn't, I guess. I took a lot of enjoyment from it.
I think I suppose it's a question of how much we get into the subtext of the film as well. You know, there's obviously it's a fairly, I think, safe to say, anti-meat production film.
it's not subtle, is it?
I couldn't help myself when the taste testers were then trying little bits of samples of the meat, thinking, a bacon sandwich, that'd be amazing.
Well, I'm a vegetarian.
So and this was very nearly going to be my first question before I was sensibly backed away from it. It made me come out of the film wanting to both consider veganism as a life choice and also going to have a bacon sandwich.
I completely agree.
That's really interesting. It reminds me of that Super Size Me film, how, you know, it makes you kind of disgusted by the concept of that, of what's happening there, but also loads of people wanted to go and buy that particular food afterwards. I have to say, this is, I think, the third film I've seen this year that's made me really consider vegetarianism as something I should do. So we saw Raw, I think it was Raw, and The Leveling as well. And now this, and I was just thinking, I feel like the universe is trying to tell me something.
Really?
Because it was just, you know, you can't argue with it. It's just, I thought it made the point really well.
I couldn't help thinking about my rabbits that I had for many years, including my rabbit Grey Cloud, because I had eaten rabbit on a few occasions, particularly at university. One little tip, don't ever stir fry rabbit, because it actually stinks the house out and makes the smell of pet shop. sorry, apologies to the vegetarian sat right next to me. But as soon as I actually had a pet rabbit, I then couldn't eat rabbit because I couldn't eat something that I'd domesticated. And that is a strong theme coming through in Okja, that actually, you know, although it's this giant hippopotamus-sized thing, it's intended to be as cute as possible, and your sympathies are levelled very squarely at Okja.
Well, there's a scene early on
that at the end.
The scene early on really humanises it when you see her relationship with the young girl and how far she goes to sort of look after her. And yeah, you're right.
They did that very well, you know, empathising with Okja and the other super pigs. And the relationship between Mija and Okja was really beautiful. I did think, in terms of the plot, I felt like I'd seen it before, that it did feel a little bit cliché at times. But then there was a lot else surrounding it that did make it, you know, quite unique.
Yeah, I think that's why the kind of the more cartoonish, outlandish stuff worked really well, because it kind of gave it something a bit different. Because I felt the same. It felt like, this feels like a lot of other films I've seen. But it was those kind of performances from Tilda Swinton and Jake Gyllenhaal and the kind of slightly wacky parts that made it a bit more memorable for me.
You've done an incredible job.
Thank you.
Hand to the old man.
Oh, hand to Johnny. Johnny.
Ever since she was little, I've always been fascinated with Okja and her monthly health reports and data. I've only known her through numbers and graphs and pictures, but seeing her here today and studying her with my own eyes and hands, she amazes me even more.
This is it, the moment of mutual trust between Miranda's very own Dr. Johnny and the esteemed local farmer.
So Bong Joon-ho co-wrote the script with John Ronson, and with some of his previous films where he's scripted The Man Who Stared at Goats, and
Frank,
thank you for that, Ben, because I had that on the tip of my tongue. And Frank, I have to say, I didn't actually like that much. That felt quite cliche to me. And there's a particular style of the male characters that come across in this film, which is present here as well. Is there a slight problem with John Ronson's scripts and this one as well in that sense?
I actually don't know how much he had to play with this film. I know that the way I've read it is that Bong Joon-ho wrote the whole script and then sent it to him and said, can you just beef up the dialogue for the English-speaking characters? I do agree, though. I think that there is definitely a style that he has with his male characters that I think maybe if someone else had done it, it would have come across better, for sure.
So there's a problem then in the sense that the male characters are probably more one-dimensional than some of the female characters, or indeed is it actually the case that every character is one-dimensional except for the rounded character of Mia, the young 10-year-old girl? Anyone can comment on that at all? We have to make for Toby editing this, the better.
She is the only, I feel, real character in the film, Mija. I think she's the one that we can all relate to. She's the one that has the kind of more widespread emotional narrative. The other characters are quite one note, but they're supposed to be. So I don't feel like... I think that's kind of what made it that sort of pantomimey, what we were talking about, sort of satirical film, because you had characters like Jake Gyllenhaal's character, who was just insane, and he was unrecognisable, to be honest. I didn't even realise it was him for a while. But he's an entertaining character, and I think we're supposed to all focus on Misha. She's the one with the real heart in the film. She's brilliant.
She's absolutely incredible. I think she's going to go far if she sticks with it. I also loved Mijar's grandfather as well. I thought he was hilarious. Yeah.
He was really funny. He was quite cartoony as well, though, wasn't
Again,
he?
Yeah, absolutely.
I felt that was something I kept thinking about with Okja, is that sort of cartoony quality it had. And it kind of, we were talking earlier about, you know, who's this film designed for? What age group would it kind of work for? And it kind of made me think of maybe some of the kind of like Studio Ghibli fans, you know, it had that kind of wacky, cartoonish quality, and also the environmental themes, which are so sort of prevalent in the Studio Ghibli films. I'm not saying that it's similar to them in all ways, but in some way it did remind me of that a little bit, and particularly the central two characters of Okja and the girl, that kind of, you know, that sort of the truth of nature, and they were just trying to live their life in a simple kind of beautiful way, and all this kind of capitalism is getting in the way, and is the kind of the evil.
There's a lot of comparisons I've heard to E.T., which I think is apt, but at the same time, that is a kid's film, and this is way too adult to show your children. It's quite harrowing at times.
I mean, for me, the lightness of Summer Tone actually then plays up the emotional investment towards the end. You know, it's broad brushstrokes, but actually it's manipulative in the sense that actually when you then come towards the end of the film and you are invested in Okja's character arc, that heightened sense of emotion brought on by the more lively characters is actually then driving you to a greater emotional response to Okja's fate. So it's that which is coming out of the lightness of character.
But then this goes back to what we were saying earlier, I think, about the sort of cliche nature of the film, the relationship between Okja and Misha, and how it was portrayed almost a little too simplistically. It just about got away with it. There was the scene where they're reunited on the big grand parade, and I was like, well, I know exactly what's going to happen here, because I felt like I've seen this kind of thing so many times before. And there were elements of that sort of just rather simplistic nature that I just think it just about got away with it.
I mean, there's certain things on here which I maybe didn't pick up while I was watching the film. Like, for example, the fact that Mija's favourite food is chicken stew. So there's a certain bit of hypocrisy going on in there as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
It'd be an interesting one for me, I think, to go back and watch a second time and see actually how much the boldness and the brashness of the characters means you miss some of that underneath. But actually, is it important for you to get these things on the first viewing, particularly on something like Netflix, where chances are you're not going to skip and rewind bits?
I think that's interesting about the Netflix distribution model, is that I think most people, I don't know about you guys, but I watch films over and over again if I love them. I think most people watch them once and then they'll move on. But with Netflix, you know, you get the opportunity to watch this 2-3 times, and you know, it's not going to cost you any more. Whereas going to the cinema 2-3 times is going to cost you £30-40. I'm looking forward to seeing it over and over again. I am very much a Bong Joon-ho fan, though, so I think a lot of my love of it came from my love of him as well. So maybe for someone that doesn't know Korean cinema or doesn't know his work, I don't know how they would react to the film.
Well, I've been to, I think, 3 Korean films with my partner this year so far, and I think she had an expectation going into those films about what Korean cinema was.
Right.
Is there a danger, because the picture house here are showing a wide variety of Korean films at the moment, that it becomes pigeonholed by films like this because they are the ones that get prominence?
My favourite film of last year was The Wailing. I don't know if you guys saw that film, which is an incredible genre piece about, it was kind of like a zombie film, but it was also like exorcisms, but it was also really funny, and that's Korean cinema to me. It's broad, but it's also very out there, which is a very strange dichotomy. But yeah, I love it. I vibe it so much.
But a film that was originally on the programme at the Arts Picture House here, and in the end didn't make it to the schedule. I ended up seeing it at Hackney, because that was the closest place I could find showing it.
Wow. But then we had The Handmaiden, which was, again, very, very different. The Age of Shadows, I don't know if you saw that. That's a wonderful film.
Again, I had to go and see it at Stevenage, because it's the closest place I could find showing. I think we're coming to a common theme here. And it's one that plays into very much Okja, because I did see it in a cinema. I saw it at the Curzon Soho in London, because on Thursday that was the only cinema in the country showing it. It's now showing at all the Curzon cinemas, but our nearest cinemas are in London. So if any of us wanted to see it in a cinema, we would have to go into London. And that's not a cheap exercise, particularly just for one film. The thing that struck me most about seeing this with a cinema audience is that actually there was a lot of laughter earlier in the film, But the emotional response towards the end was so heightened that you could actually hear people sort of gasping and, oh no,
sniffling,
as the final scenes played out. And that to me is what's missing from that home experience the most, that you don't get that emotional engagement. Sometimes you'll see a middling comedy which you actually enjoy more at the time because the rest of the audience around you is laughing, or it'll be dragged down because they're not.
100%. I've rewatched The Hangover recently and I thought it was okay, but I remember seeing that in the cinema crying with laughter because the whole cinema was packed with just people rolling in the aisles, and it just, you're right, it heightened it so much.
Yeah, I remember going to see Get Out this year at the cinema, and just at the final scene, I won't say what it was, but there was just a real palpable joint feeling in the audience, and that was something that was really memorable and kind of really added to the power of the film, I think. Yeah.
I think the question comes in is about what we as audiences can try and do to try and encourage films like this into cinemas. And I think for me the Netflix and the Amazon model is slightly different because Amazon have distributed these films, but they've got good cinema distribution. Yeah. But they're not reliant on those films on their platform to generate their revenue. They it's one of many streams for them. Netflix is purely their distribution platform. They are about subscribers. So it's not about a particular film. It's about you becoming a subscriber, which you don't become if you see a film in a cinema.
Yeah.
Is there any way to resolve this?
I haven't got the foggiest.
So the reason that Netflix is sort of keen to give people free rein is because they will make a film that they can then put it on their service, but what they get from you is your monthly subscription fee. They don't get a charge for each film you've watched. So actually, they don't care if you watch that content or not. If that content has brought you to that service and you've become a subscriber, that's what's important to them, not the fact whether you've watched the content or not. So a film can end up disappearing down their algorithm and never being watched. But if it's the one that made you sign up out of curiosity, then it's done its job. So actually, the content is less important than maybe the talent involved. So, selling it off the back of a Tilda Swinton or a Jake Gyllenhaal is less important than it's a Bong Joon-ho film in this sense.
But also, don't forget Netflix. I think this is actually a bit of a marketing thing as well. I don't think they see films as their selling point. I think Netflix rely a lot on the strength they have some excellent TV series.
100%.
And that is very much, I think the reason people would subscribe, it wouldn't be for a single film. It would more likely be
House
for
of
the
Cards,
range
Orange
of,
is the New Black,
of programs of and that are on Netflix. So I think from that level, a film like Oaksha would not draw people to go to Netflix. And that might be a kind of sad thing because maybe fewer people will see it that way.
But this is the way that they're going with the content now. And you look at David Michaud's film War Machine. He made the fantastic Animal Kingdom and War Machine, another one produced with Plan B, who also, Brad Pitt's production company, who produced Oakja. And it's because of their deal with Netflix, this is where it's ended up. And these films are ending up on this platform because that's the only route somebody can actually get into to even getting made.
I think if you look at the pros and cons, just for me personally, I think the con is I didn't see this in the cinema and I would have loved to. It would have been incredible. The pros are they're giving young filmmakers, auteurs, massive chances to get their film seen. And they're funding them as well.
And giving them that creative control.
And not putting their oar in at all, exactly. So I think that's an amazing place to be. And it's just going to inspire more creativity, I think. It's not going to be for everyone. Every film, isn't going to hit every audience. But I love that too. If you go too broad, I think you dilute the message.
But obviously, this is becoming more and more of a thing. As we say, they focused on their TV in the past, but they are now starting to produce more and more films. And you've got that divide from Cannes, where they said they won't show films from next year that are not screening theatrically. So, this is going to become a battle which doesn't go away. It's the line is going to be drawn somewhere and people are going to have to pick sides.
Netflix spend millions and millions on these Adam Sandler films and everyone gives them one star. They're all awful, but Netflix say they are the most watched films on their platform. Everyone watches them. I've seen them. Just one day you're bored and you just put it on. So I think that's really interesting. The critics don't really matter to them. You said it doesn't matter if they watch it or not, to be fair. They just want it there as part of their brand.
That doesn't necessarily mean much for us, though, as people who are trying to find the best in cinema. Netflix is not a service that lends itself to finding films particularly well. I spent about a day trying to find some of the older classic films and even some of the more modern re-releases that I'd not managed to catch in the cinema. And Netflix does not encourage you to try and find these films.
Sure.
You know, I've got a list of about 60 films now I've put together. But it's taken some really hard work to get at that list of films that I want to watch. So we're very much in the hands of Netflix themselves as to what is available as content by what they think we want to watch with the sort of trending lists. And
they do have a very weird algorithm, don't they? I think the other day it said, because you like Pulp Fiction, you should watch Magic Mike XXL. I
was like, well, don't diss Magic Mike.
I'm not, but I'm saying, just because you like Pulp Fiction, I don't know where that... My relation goes.
My most famous example of that bugbear is when I'd watched Richard Ayoade's Submarine on the service, and it recommended The Hunt for Red October and
I get very similar stuff because I got Netflix to watch Trollhunters by Guillermo del Toro. It's a kids' TV series.
Yeah.
And then my feed just filled up with all these kids shows. I was like, well, I just watched the one. But I don't know. So at some point soon, I think Netflix is going to get a kick. I'm just going to call it a kick. Borrow liberally from Inception as I do so. And someone over there is going to realise, hold on, if we can do a joint distribution, we are probably going to make more money out of it by putting stuff in the cinemas and then saying, and also you can watch it at home the next day in the comfort of your own home. You know, if they just do a staggered release of a day or something like that, because I would much rather have seen Okja outside of the comfort of my own home, because the comfort of my own home also includes thumping bass from one of my housemates, you know, other people wandering around the house, all these distractions that I can't filter out. In a cinema, the worst thing I have is probably someone next to me fidgeting, or the idiots down in the front row using their phones where everyone can see them. Luckily, I'm a fantastic shot with a jelly bean, and more than one person has experienced my wrath. But
they can coexist.
Yes.
Netflix and cinemas can coexist. I don't think it's extreme, and I think Dave's right. I think in the future, not now, because of everything that's going on with the Cannes drama.
That could be the kick, though. That could be something where Netflix says, "Well, fine then. Let us into the cinemas, and we'll do it."
Yeah, there is one other thing which could be the kick, and that's the award season. Because for most of the big awards ceremonies, the Oscars, the BAFTAs, and so on, you have to have some form of theatrical run, even now, even before this all kicked off, to qualify for that. So it's got to be shown in the cinema somewhere at some point.
But you're right about the Amazon model. Amazon Prime are their competitor mainly, aren't they? But they funded Manchester by the Sea, and that got a huge wide release and obviously won all the Oscars. And so I don't see why Netflix can't do the same thing, really.
I think as long as Netflix continues to be pioneering kind of creative talent and bringing interesting things, I guess the danger is, or maybe this is just me being pessimistic, is that things start to get developed because of algorithms. So, you know, if you like this and this and this, you might just say, this, it's another film about a pig, but in this pig film, it's Peppa Pig.
I live in fear of people watching Peppa Pig and then being recommended. Or the other way around. I'm not quite sure which is worse.
They do need to sort that out.
Yeah, you liked Babe Pig in the City, so you should watch Sex in the City.
So, as we said, Okja became available to watch this past Wednesday on Netflix. Although, if you want to hunt down a Curzon cinema somewhere across the country, you can see it on the big screen if you're desperate for that experience. So our last film on today's show is a familiar face as we take a quick look at the re-release of The Graduate, directed by Mike Nichols in 1967, and now back in the big screen at the Arts Picture House. It seems oddly appropriate that Baby Driver, a film which takes its name from a Simon and Garfunkel B-side, is in cinemas at the same time as a feature film featuring one of the folk rock duo's most iconic musical moments. Here's to you, Mrs. Robinson.
Hey, there's the award-winning scholar!
We're all very proud of you, Ben.
What is it, Ben?
I guess about my future.
Do you find me undesirable?
Oh, no, Mrs. Robinson. I think you're the most attractive of all my parents' friends.
I don't want to close my eyes. I might miss something.
Maybe we could do something else together. Mrs. Robinson, would you like to go to a movie?
The world is changing faster than you.
Say hello to Mrs. Robinson, Benjamin. Hello, Benjamin.
Hello, Mrs. Robinson.
Hey, Ben. Elaine's coming down from Berkeley soon. I want you to call her up.
Elaine away from you, I am prepared to tell her everything.
I just don't believe you would do that.
Try me.
That woman, that older woman that I told you about?
Benjamin, will you just tell me what this is all about?
Oh, Dustin Hoffman's Ben has recently graduated from college, with his parents expecting great things. At his homecoming party, the wife of his father's business partner, played by Anne Bancroft, has Ben drive her home, and the two gradually begin an affair. The affair ends, but comes back to haunt Ben when Ben falls for Elaine, Mrs. Robinson's daughter, played by Catherine Ross. So, Yossi, did the graduate manage to seduce you?
Kind of. that's not the best answer I could give. It is great, I have to say. The first time I saw it was a long time ago. And this was, I think, before I even went to university. So it was quite interesting seeing it now, having graduated. And, you know, that first bit where he's sat with a lot of older people and they're, you know, they're asking all these questions about what his plan is. And I think Dustin Hoffman is just actually really great in it, because he's got this sort of look on his face. He's just really amusing. He's sort of got no emotions and he's just got deadpan, and it's really good. And that was relevant to me, because I remember having those conversations when I graduated. What are you going to do next? And you're like, oh, I don't know, stop asking me. So it's quite interesting from that perspective. It is very humorous. It's very satirical, and I think that's the best thing about it. I think watching it from kind of a modern perspective, you know, it's 2017 now, and this is, I guess, it's 50 years old. It's a bit weird, the kind of predatory relationship going on between Anne Bancroft's character and Dustin Hoffman's character. I can't help but think if it was the other way around, especially if it was an older man and a young lady, how we would treat that. So I suppose in that sense it could be quite problematic, but I mean, it's a classic, isn't it?
Well, I mean, things have to earn their reputation, I guess, to a certain extent. Ben, you've seen this before, although not as recently as Yossi.
Yes.
This morning?
I haven't seen it in probably the best part of a decade, I would say. But
of your memories of it, do you think it holds up today?
My memories of it are all fantastic. I saw it very young, maybe like 13, I think I was. And needless to say, me being called Ben as well, related to the main character, and, you know, was always holding out for a relationship with an older lady, maybe, that never right. exactly came.
Whereas I related to a small elephant with big ears.
But yeah, no, I love this film. As you say, it's a classic, and it has to earn that over time. Very funny, very moving. As I said, it was a different time, and it is a little bit weird with the values, I suppose, but you do find that a lot from 60s and 70s cinema, don't you?
I think in terms of one of the things coming across from the film, it's the sort of detachment of the younger generation. You know, there's a clear separation between the two, because no one of that older generation is ever called by their first name in the film.
It's really
trying to make that separation.
That's a good point.
You know, we're living in 2017, where so much has been made of the young voice in this country, particularly going through the recent
general
elections.
It's very relevant now, actually, the sort of generational divide. I do think that will resonate with a lot of people now. That's something I think translates very, very well.
But at the same time, I think it's also actually how well those politics, the sexual politics and the other things going on in the 60s work these days, and, you know, particularly with the sort of hindsight we've got of 50 years of it. And I suppose I was struck by the fact that it's actually some of Mike Nichols' direction, where particularly when they're first confronted in the bedroom scene, and you just see Dustin Hoffman having little two or three frame flashes where he sees a little bit of the body. I can't help but think if that film was made today, there'd probably be some sort of full frontal sex
absolutely.
Scene. We there's an inhibition there, which actually is maybe more effective for when it was, but would it actually work today?
That's a really good point.
I'm not sure it would, actually.
It wouldn't be as subtle, would it?
Yeah, no, I definitely wouldn't. I think you watch it now and I think you appreciate it as something that was made in the 60s. I think that's the only way you can watch it, because if you try and translate that to now, it just won't work as a film.
I'm really sad I didn't get a chance to see it this week, because it's just been jam-packed, but I will definitely go back to it. And you saw it on Netflix, did you say? Or no, it's on YouTube.
You can rent it on YouTube, actually, which is another, I guess...
I'll probably do as well that. As Amazon, iTunes and various other rental services.
So. I'll do that this evening.
we'll tell anyone about it, but just while we're on that subject, you can also see it at the Arts Picture House over the next couple of weeks. It's showing in next week's Vintage Sundays and the After Dark after that. It's a certificate 15. So, I think, Yossi, on that basis, is it worth going to catch in the cinema?
Yeah, it is. I definitely think you should go and see it. It's just such a classic film, and it is a really good film. I don't want to take anything away from it. A couple of points. I really wish Elaine, the character played by...
Catherine Ross.
Catherine Ross. She's just a bit bland. Actually, watching it again now, I feel like she's a very bland character, and she's probably the only likeable character, because I feel like most of the characters are just not very likeable at all. But I suppose that's kind of the point. That's why you laugh at them. But yeah, I do wish she was a bit more, you know, she had a bit more oomph, because she was quite bland.
One of the things that struck me at the watching the end of the film was how it feels like it's the next generation making the same generation's mistakes. You had Mrs. Robinson, who, you know, had ended up in a marriage because she became pregnant, and, you know, you've now got Dustin Hoffman and Catherine Ross running away, you know, ending up in a situation which was that forced rebellion, but they've put themselves in that same situation of not knowing where they're going next, and you're left with this final shot of the despair on their faces. Hopefully you don't mind spoilers, listeners, because this has been out 50 years. And that last shot is very iconic, as indeed is the shot in the church, which I think everyone here knows from Wayne's World 2, shows our age. I think that's a general recommendation to see it in cinema. So, Ben, you'll be pleased to know you've got a couple of chances to go and catch it.
I absolutely will. I can't even believe I forgot that it's out in the cinema. But, yeah, no, I will. I will check it out there.
Was he slow? No. No. Good kid. Devil behind the wheel. Was he slow? Retarded means slow. Was he slow? No. What the hell else more do you need to know?
So, I think that's sadly all we've got time for on the show today. As always, there'll be another chance to hear the last hour with our repeat coming this Monday at 11. Plus, there'll be a podcast with undoubtedly more material released on Tuesday. You can get hold of that either from our page on the Cambridge 105 website or through iTunes. Just search for Bums on Seats and up we pop. Don't forget, you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter if you'd like to say hello or to chat with us about any more of the films. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time on July the 15th with a show that may well be catching up with the latest big Hollywood blockbusters of the summer. There's Spider-Man Homecoming, the sixth Spider-Man film in the last 17 years, but the first to take place in the same cinematic universe as Iron Man and Captain America. I've just lost my car for failing to say the word cinematic. There's also War of the Planet of the Apes, the third film in that series and about the ninth overall, and Cars 3. Plus there's The Beguiled, Sofia Coppola's adaptation of the Southern Gothic novel by Thomas Cullinan. We also may have a preview of the Rainer Werner Fassbinder season that is coming up at the Arts Picture House. Please stay tuned for Cambridge Arts Review. But from all of us here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.
Was he slow?